to the law school and to this particularly significant occasion. We academics are an unusual breed. The rest of the world, people celebrate marriages or mergers or military victories. At the law school and in academics, we celebrate books. Writing a book is pretty much the pinnacle of academic achievement, and so it really is a pleasure to join you in this celebration of Enemy of the State, a new book by our own Michael Newton and his co-author from Case Western, Michael Scharf. Now, ordinarily, if I were introducing an academic, I would simply say that John Smith has been at Vanderbilt Law School for 30 years and that he's the Tom and Susan Jones Professor of Law, and we could leave it at that. But in fact, there's a bit more of a story with respect to Mike. And so let me just take a couple of minutes to tell you that. We've engaged here at Vanderbilt at an effort to really rethink legal education. And part of that has been a reformulation of the second and third year curriculum, which has been involved dividing our faculty into working teams and having those teams design and deliver a coherent educational program in the second and third years. And one of the successors of that effort, one of its glories, is our international program, begun really in an effort to take full account of this extraordinarily important area of practice. You know, it's a long time ago that international law could be confined to a few coastal cities and a few coastal law schools. It's now a crucial part of the legal system and the economic system of the United States, and so it was very important to us to create that program. And its architect and current director is Professor Larry Helfer, who is obviously here in the front row with us. Now, one of, I could describe in great detail the program, but I'll just leave it with that notion that it's a coherently designed curriculum conjoined with a series of intellectual or research-oriented events such as speaker series and conferences and things of that sort. Now, one of Larry's really great insights and great initiatives was to think of bringing Mike Newton to this campus. Mike, it's not that Mike didn't have a distinguished career. He had a very distinguished career, but it wasn't a typical career for an academic at a law school. Mike began his career, or began his military career, as an armor officer in the 68th Armored Division, located based in Colorado. And from there became an operational military attorney, served with the Armed Forces Airborne Command based in Fort Bragg, and participated in Desert Storm in that capacity. He then became a professor of international and operational law at the Judge Advocate General School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Finally, after a number of other positions, he served as a senior advisor to the United States Ambassador at Large for war crimes issues in the U.S. Department of State. So this was a very distinguished legal career in the Army and through the Army with various other parts of the government, but that is not the place from which we recruit faculty. It was really Larry's vision to envision a role for Mike and all of us that this would be a real success. All we can say is that we can all pat ourselves on for having done this, because Mike has done an amazing job creating a truly unique program. One of the things, as I mentioned, we have groups of faculty working together. Mike is working in the area of experiential education. His technical title is a professor of the practice, or a clinical professor, but this here at Vanderbilt is unique in that it's fully integrated with all other aspects of the program. He works as a team with the people, with the other faculty members who provide classroom instruction in this area. Mike has created an international law laboratory which trains students to do real international law and international human rights work, and then they actually do it. Sometimes by placing the students in various settings, either here or overseas, and sometimes by doing the work here at Vanderbilt that is then sent on and used in other places. And some of their work was used in the Iraqi trial. You're going to hear a great deal about that. So I want to mention another publication of Mike's that we're not going to talk about today. And that is that he, together with his students, produced a document, a white paper, entitled A Case for Revoking the Credentials of the SPDC, which is the current regime controlling Burma or Myanmar, and arguing that the UN General Assembly should reject the credentials of the representatives of this regime. Again, the work was done through with Mike's organization, by him and by the students, and it's currently being considered by the United Nations. I just will state the conclusion as a way of indicating the significance of this and the conscience which it represents. These actions, and he's referring to the way the regime responded to Cyclone Nargis, these actions constitute crimes against humanity. The failure to warn and the withholding and abuse of humanitarian aid, both of which substantially increase the death toll, amount to the crime against humanity of murder. And as I said, this is something that is before the United Nations now. It's just typical of another example of the kind of work that Mike does in this wonderful program that he's created. We're here now, of course, to hear not only about that not about that program, but about this great intellectual achievement of he and his co-author, the Enemy of the State. Mike?
Thank you. Thank you, Ed. Those are very kind words. I was introduced by a friend not too long ago in a very different audience, and he simply said, "This is Mike Newton." He said, "The less said about him, the better," and that pretty much got it. We're here today to talk about the book and many of the things that are in the book, and to try to give a broader perspective on what the book is, not just what it's about, but to try to put its place in history in focus. It was a very deliberate theme in the book, is the context of these Iraqi trials as they stand in historical context. So, as with any good law school class, the first thing you do is we set the ground rules. The ground rules are, this is a discussion, this is a dialogue. You have some of the greatest legal minds, literally in the world, that have come from around the world, gathered together here. All four of these panelists, to include myself, are pretty knowledgeable about this process. So if there are questions and misconceptions and comments, this is a dialogue, and we've structured it in that way. Think of this as the Vanderbilt Enemy of the State fireside chat, you know, the chance to sort of dialogue. So in pursuance of that, what we decided to do is to have just a couple of preliminary observations from each one of us, what we think are the two or three most critical sort of things, background things to understand. This is, of course, very topical given the news last week and all the recurrence of issues. So what we decided to do is to have a couple of key issues apiece, which I will then begin. And then I will sort of ride honcho on taking questions from the audience and queuing them up. And we'll have a conversation amongst ourselves and a conversation with you, which says if you're too shy to raise your hand, then it's your loss. Because here's your chance to have this dialogue. So my two issues first. The first is to understand, as so few people from outside Iraq do. My first trip to Iraq was in December of 2003. I had done a lot of previous work in developing the statute and in trying to help them think through the process of creating an internationalized tribunal. And in the context of doing that, I had to learn an awful lot, a steep learning curve, about the legal traditions here. What they set about doing was a very bold project. Literally, you might say they staked the soul of their nation on this project. It was a very bold project. And the idea was simply this. Rather than sort of vigilante justice, rather than allowing events on the ground to take control, the goal of the Interim Governing Council was to get ahead of that. Long before Saddam was captured, what they said was, let's create a process to bring not just Saddam Hussein, but all the leading Ba'athists. If you read the statute, it's about the Ba'athists who controlled Iraq. There's a great misconception that says that widespread societal crimes against humanity are a factor of lawlessness. In fact, it's the other way around. It takes an organized, concentrated, unanimous effort of state power taking control of the law, hijacking the law, to carry out massive societal crimes on the level and the sustained way of doing this. One of the results of that, of course, was that Judge Rod and his brothers inside Iraq were largely shielded from developments in international law. The law of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, they were shielded from. So what we had to do was to create a structure for building in that body of law into the domestic structure and then teaching and training those judges how to apply it, which makes perfect sense because the dictator whose regime survives and thrives based on crimes against humanity does not and cannot tolerate an independent judicial system that's schooled in the nuances of this body of modern international law. So that was the first thing, is that these trials don't take place in a vacuum. They take place against a very rich legal tradition and a very complex, well-developed body of criminal law. That's my point one. Point two, and I say this by way of introduction of my friends and my colleagues here. The dedication of the book reads as follows. It says, to Riyadh and to John, and all those who have sacrificed at the altar of human freedom and dignity. Now, Riyadh and John themselves are both incredible, moving, powerful stories of human sacrifice and courage and patriotism. You can read about them on our website. But they each represent this much broader range of people. In a sense, and it's not much of an extrapolation, that dedication to those who have sacrificed on behalf of the rule of law and human freedom applies to all of my friends and co-panelists. What we tried to do in this book is to capture this process, the human stories, the human drama, the human sacrifice, and put it into context. All three of my friends and colleagues here, I would put at the very forefront of those who have sacrificed and spent enormous amounts of their time and their professional careers for no other purpose than to do what's right. Not what's easy, but to do what's right. And for that, we honor them. Let me introduce my friends and colleagues to you. This is Judge Rod Juhi, who was a judge in the Central Criminal Court of Iraq. He spent a number of years working his way through the very complex, rigorous procedures to become an Iraqi judge. He then became, after my first trip in December of 2003, the chief investigative judge of the Iraqi High Tribunal. This is a man of integrity, of courage, whose values he lives every day. In doing that, he and his family both suffered enormous things. Judge Rod was the chief investigative judge responsible for coordinating both the jail trial, which is the subject of this book, as well as the much more complex Anfal genocide case, which unfolded across all of northern Iraq. It was his efforts and his team that pulled those two crimes together. Judge Rod will speak, followed by them as Mark Ellis. Very long, dignified career of public service. He most notably was a director of the American Bar Association ABA Sealy Project. Now imagine what we did in Iraq on the much broader scale of Eastern Europe and Central Europe. As those tyrannies begin to fall and the rule of law begins to take hold, Mark was one of the ones at the spearhead of developing domestic infrastructures and domestic rule of law systems that had the strength to survive those turbulent times in those societies. Today, he is the executive director of the International Bar Association in London and is a tremendously powerful voice, not just from London, but all around the world, dealing with local bars, dealing with issues of international concern, and had a very key role, which I'm sure he will tell you about and we will talk about as the panel goes, in this trial and the processes thereof. And then last, of course, on the far end, my friend and co-author, Michael Scharf. Michael is one of those names in our field that literally anywhere you go in the world, If you say Michael P. Scharf, you have their attention, because his academic record is known. His friends are legion around the world. This book, and simply put, this book would not have been written without his expertise and his involvement and his sense of justice. It was Michael who helped us as we began to spearhead and pull together the training programs. This enormously complex process of taking domestic judges, and this is not unique to Iraq. The same thing would have happened in Texas if you took Texas judges and said, you're going to do these massively complicated international trials. They would say, help us learn. And it was Michael, among others, who stepped to the forefront to coordinate and to lead those projects. So the Iraqis and literally the rest of mankind owe all of these people a great debt. And with that, my friend Judge Rott.
First of all, thank you so much, Mike, about this introduction. Actually, it's my honor to be with you here. I'm thinking about these issues. A couple of Mikes invite me to say, it's okay, what I have to say in this event is talk about book, talk about the rule of law. I said, look, this court is very important for both societies, U.S. and Iraqis. Why? For the Iraqis, and why for U.S.? For Iraqi, if we look to the Iraqis' history, not far history, it's just modern history, like 50 years ago, from 1958 until 2008. Compare that history, what done there with the Iraqi High Tribunal. I will mention this small pieces here, just to remind you, and after that, compare that with the IHT. 1958, this first military coup in Iraq. And before 1958, we have a king, and Iraq as a kingdom that time. And Abdul Karim Qasim, the first general, he's had a coup that time. And same day, same minute, he go over the government, he killed the king and his family. Second day, they arrested the prime minister in that time, and they killed him also, without a trial. Nothing. The good thing for them, they have a grave in Baghdad. 5 years later, which 1963, first Ba'ath Corps came, and they did same thing with Abdul Karim Qasim. They killed Abdul Karim Qasim in same day with all his assistants, without a trial, in same day. You know, but there is turning points also in that time. There is no grave for Abdul Karim Qasim, because when they killed him, they throw his body to the river in Baghdad. For that reason, the first republic in Iraqi's history, after 1958, there is no grave for him in Iraq. Because when the Ba'ath go over the government, they killed him and sent him to the river. 7 years later, 5 years later, the second coup of the Ba'athists, when Saddam and his groups came to the control of the government, 2 years later, there is a famous court in Iraq. It's called An-Nihaya Palace. Qasr An-Nihaya in Arabic. An-Nihaya Palace. An-Nihaya is the final. You know. An-Nihaya Palace, the judge in that time, he's one of the special assistant for Saddam Hussein. His name is Taha Yassir Ramadan. Taha Yassir Ramadan, he's one of our accused during the jail case. He's the judge of the An-Nihaya court, because they created court, special court, and they killed 500 individuals in one day for nothing, just because they sent message to the Iraqi government, to the Iraqi people, we are here, or we are strong. And there is conspiracy theory around the scope, or some people think about revolution, kind of that. But in reality, there is nothing. 1979, when Saddam took as a president of Iraq, in same day, he gave a speech in public. And he said, I will mention some names in the audience. And each person, I will mention his name, he has to be stand up and leave this hall. And he mentioned several names of the highest leader of Ba'ath in that time. Each one stand up and he left. And he arrested in the door, which is this famous and public story. He killed all of them in the same day, without any trial. He killed most of the leaders that time. I don't like to go over all this to continue because it's long, long stories during the Iraqi's history. Same thing, 1992. I'm talking about trials here. 1992, July also. Iraqi government arrested 200 merchants in July 24th, evening 24th, they arrest them. July 26th, 5 o'clock, they execute 40 of them. They investigate them, they arrested them, investigate them, trial them, appeal them in 36 hours and execute them. Not just that, and take all the property from them and send the bodies to their families and let them and tell them strong message, there is no consul, nothing. Take your bodies and go to the graveyard. That's it. This history, if we look at this history from 1958, when the first cop came and people in that time killed the king, and compare that history with the Iraqi High Tribunal. That's a huge difference. Because there is, after 2003, the first time in Iraq, we have real legal process. We have rule of law. We have justice. Many people will say, here in West and different fields, this is Iraqi High Tribunal, it's big show. It's nothing, it's fake trial, it's okay. I think they miss two things here. They miss Iraqi High Tribunal, its local court, which is Iraqi systems came from the civil law, which is totally different about the common law. That's one. Second thing, they miss Iraqi history, which is very important for their society. How to Iraqi High Tribunal teach or educate Iraqi society. If we took Saddam and execute him same day, nothing. We'll continue on same chaos. Day after day, generation after generation, we'll kill each other. But if we start with the legal process and we send this message, we have to stop the chaos and we have to continue with the rule of law. And we have to be proud of our responsibility to bring the rule of laws back and bring the justice back to Iraq. It's very important. We have legal process, we have real trial process, we have evidence, documents, witnesses, victims, and we have defendants. We have defense counsel. All this legal process came with the IHT. This issue is very important with the modern history for Iraq. Maybe there is some mistakes right now, but it's okay. The result will come in next generation, next decade. If we look to the IHT handling like, I will go over smoothly over 35 years because the jurisdiction for the IHT this came from 1968 until 2003. We have thousands of victims during the Anfal campaign, which is around 100,000 people killed in 1988. The Iraqi government in that time used the chemical gas and different kind of weapons to kill these guys. And also destroy around more than 4,000 villages in Kurdistan, which is north of Iraq, and took most of the property there. 1991, during the South issues, they also did the same thing. Iraqi government kills around 200,000 of the Iraqis individual, children, women, and men, and send them to the mass graves. Iraqi High Tribunal listened to all these victims, not all, most of them, victims and witnesses. And also, we pick around 21 tons of documents, and we set up electronics data to look over all these documents. This legal process is very important. And should be Iraqi people is proud about this legal process, because they, this process will give them good future. I mention here is Iraq should be proud about this court, because turning point for the Iraqi justice. And also mention something different. I said, should be American society and American citizen proud about Iraqi High Tribunal. Maybe some people will say, why? Why we're not Iraqi? I said, not. Because without American support, we can't set up the rule of law in Iraq. Frankly, we didn't get support from UN in that time. The only support we get it from the US, which is the main support, and from other countries, with Australia and British, and some organizations. US advisors, US money, US attorneys, soldiers, FBIs, many individual different kinds, they working with us, shoulder to shoulder, to build rule of law there. They gave strong message to Iraqi people. They said, we are American, we'll help you to return your justice here. For that reason, I think, and I'm sure, the US citizen and US society should be proud of their soldiers there, because they are spent money, blood, time to help Iraq. In my area, to build rule of law there. And send this rule of law to Iraqi government and Iraqi people, which is very important. I don't like to take more time because I have another 2 minutes. But I want to say 2 words here. You have to know the fact. And you know the fact from people work on grounds. People work on grounds, you have distinguished opportunity to talk to both author of this book, because both of them start with the Iraqi High Tribunal from the beginning. Maybe one of them, he never has opportunity to work on a ground in Iraq. But Newton, Professor Newton, he spent many time there. And he, one of the few number of people knows exact fact about the Iraqi rule of law. And I'm sure this book mentioned many, many of these issues. I will talk about, I said these issues just to remind you about the Iraqi history and what this court and what the Iraqi High Tribunal is important. And I keep saying it is turning point for the Iraqi justice. Thank you.
Well, it is a real honor to be here at Vanderbilt to celebrate with my co-author the launch of our book, and to be with old friends, the Dean and Larry, and new friends in the audience. And it's a real honor to have worked with Judge Rod, who really I consider a living hero, someone who really put it out there. And when you read the book, he emerges really as the person, I think, that fares the best in this whole process, and who at every single occasion is striving for justice and to do things right. While Judge Rod and his colleagues were going through literally rooms and rooms of documents that ultimately were going to convict Saddam by his own signatures, the regime crimes liaison people at the U.S. Embassy had decided the time had come to start to train the Iraqi judges who would have to prosecute these crimes. And I got a call 4 years ago in July of 2004 from Baghdad, and I was sitting in Cleveland. But even though we had just invaded and the country was sort of under repair, this was a crystal clear line. It sounded like it was just coming from down the street. And a booming voice that was a little bit in my ear like Darth Vader, if you know this guy, Greg Kehoe, is on the other end of the line. And he says, Professor Michael Scharf. And I said, yes, that's me. He says,
How would you like to help us train the judges who will prosecute Saddam Hussein? And I was really taken aback because although I had worked with Mark Ellis and his colleagues in training Iraqi judges in Dubai in human rights law, I had trained former Soviet Union judges in Prague on human rights law, I had worked with international tribunals in Yugoslavia and Rwanda and later in Cambodia and knew a lot about training judges, Iraq was not on my radar screen at all. And the reason was because I had been very public in, one, my opposition to the war, and two, my thought that a U.S.-supported Iraqi High Tribunal was going to look to the world like a U.S. puppet court and would lack legitimacy if the U.N. was not involved, if it was not an international tribunal. And so I mentioned this to Greg, and he said, yes, yes, we know about your stance. And he says, but Professor, he actually said two things that convinced me. The first one is, but Professor Scharf, we have Mike Newton working with us. That went a long way. The second one was this. He said, do you want to stand on the outside and through your academic writings just hurl insults at this court? Or do you want to get on the inside and try to make it a more fair, more effective process? If it has any hope of succeeding, we need people like you to be part of the court. And that was a really tough challenge for me because on the one hand, I was thinking, well, I don't want to be used as a propaganda tool to legitimize a tribunal that I don't agree with. But on the other hand, how can you have such a great opportunity to help shape an institution and not take advantage of it? If you really care about the world, how often do you get those chances in life to make a difference? And finally, he said, look, when you're done with us, you could publish and say anything you want about your experience. If you think the whole court is a bunch of hogwash, you write that. And when you read our book, you'll see at times we do say that. We're very critical of some aspects of the court. Things that you've been reading about, Mark will tell you more about, lately in the New York Times, first appeared in our book a couple of weeks before the story broke in the New York Times. But what I want to do is spend a few minutes today talking about the extraordinary challenge of trying to train judges to prosecute a tyrant on trial. And this isn't the first time this has happened. Saddam Hussein was preceded 60 years earlier by Hermann Göring, and just 10 years earlier by Slobodan Milosevic. And whenever you have a former leader on trial, there are challenges that judges just don't face in ordinary courts of law. For example, an ordinary defendant wants to get acquitted, and his lawyer wants to help him get acquitted. And to do that, they play by the rules and they try to prove their case in court. A former leader on trial is most likely to assume that he has no chance at all of being acquitted. And therefore, he is not going to play by the rules. In fact, he has a whole nother agenda. What he wants to do is totally distract the trial from the things that are being said about him. He wants to be turned into a martyr by provoking the judges into being inappropriately harsh toward him. He wants to try to derail the trial by making speeches that will try to repropagandize the people in the country about why he did what he did. Not saying that he's sorry for what he did, but re-legitimizing all these terrible things. And finally, in Saddam's case, most interestingly, his lawyer went public halfway through the trial and said, "It is our strategy to try to make this trial so sidetracked and last so long as the insurgency continues outside the courtroom that ultimately the Americans will decide that the only way they're going to get peace is by letting Saddam go in an asylum for peace deal." And so what they were trying to do is just hijack the trial. They weren't at all trying to play by the rules. Well, what is a judge to do faced with that? The judge needs to make sure the court seems fair. It has to be fair, but it has to appear fair. But it also has to be effective and efficient. And there has to be some respect for the decorum of the court procedures. And so the first thing that Mike and I suggested is that no matter what you do, if the defendants are trying to represent themselves in the courtroom and they start to act disruptively, that is a privilege that can be revoked. And we felt that the Yugoslavia Tribunal had made a mistake in not revoking Slobodan Milosevic's privilege of self-representation early enough, and that it had learned its lesson, and that the Iraqi High Tribunal should apply the same lesson. In fact, the Iraqi legislature passed a law that said that defendants before the Iraqi High Tribunal cannot represent themselves. They have to be represented by lawyers who could be controlled as you control lawyers. Most of you are going to be lawyers. You'll know that if you misbehave, you can be fined. You could be sent to jail for a night or two. You can be suspended or even disbarred for acting inappropriately in the courtroom. You can't do any of that to a self-represented defendant. You don't, can't find them. They don't have any money. They're already in jail. And even though Saddam, like Milosevic, were lawyers, they weren't practicing. So what did they care if you suspended or revoked their license? So we thought we had solved this problem when that law was passed. But interestingly, this is a lesson of this whole process. If you are training judges from a foreign country, especially one that is as different from the Western system as the Iraqi civil law model is, you just don't know exactly how your lessons are going to translate the first time around. And it turned out that the Iraqis decided to allow Saddam to, in effect, act as his own co-counsel. He was able to ask questions of any witness at any time. He was able to stand up and make any motions or complaints to the court at any time. This is on live TV, and he took advantage of this on 30 different occasions in a 38-day trial that lasted 9 months. Now, that, I think, was the first huge problem for the court, because it lost control of the proceedings. Once Saddam was able to do this, it was very hard to rein him in. When the first judge was pressured out for being too lenient on the defendants, and a new judge came in, Judge Ralph, and he tried to reestablish a harder line in the courtroom, then the defendants, and they're sort of, the defense counsel and the defendants together are sort of like mad scientists experimenting with every way to wreck the court proceedings, and the judges have to be like other kinds of scientists racing the clock to find remedies and antidotes to this behavior, and it's really a cycle that keeps getting met with action and counteraction. So when Judge Ralph started to clamp down, they tried something new, the mass walkout, the boycott. And then Judge Ralph tried something new. He said, if you're not going to be in the courtroom and if the defense counsel won't be in, we're going to have appointed standby counsel who will represent you. The press didn't get this at all. One of the sad things, while I was reading and seeing TV reports about the trial, is that the press kept saying that Saddam was not represented by counsel today. And in fact, what they meant was that his retained lawyers had boycotted the proceedings, but they forgot to mention that the court itself had appointed defense counsel. And one of the things is that these defense counsel were being assisted in the background by a fellow who's in the news now this week, Bill Wiley from Canada, who was a very distinguished defense counsel who had practiced before the Rwanda Tribunal and the Yugoslavia Tribunal. And he helped them in every way imaginable so that there really would be equality of arms in the courtroom. One of the most amazing moments that we talk about in our book is at the end of the trial, where Saddam Hussein's defense lawyers are watching the trial and the final proceedings from another country, where they're doing a press conference saying, we're not participating because the whole thing is a sham. And instead, the retained or the court-appointed defense counsel are going to do the closing arguments. And Saddam Hussein stands up and he points his finger at the very tiny and scared-looking appointed defense counsel who was assigned this task. And he says, if you give a closing argument on my behalf, I will consider you the enemy of the state and my personal enemy. And this is actually where we get the title of the book, because what Saddam was saying to this fellow is, you will be killed, because this is on TV, and everybody else outside just heard me say this, and this is a death sentence. And this little diminutive defense counsel took a sip of water, and he shook, and he stood up, and we're watching and saying, what's going to happen? And he gave a four-hour closing argument that was incredible. It was so good that one of the defendants was acquitted, three got light sentences, and unfortunately Saddam had convicted himself on the strength of his own documents, and also one day on March 1st in court where he said he was responsible and basically confessed in open court and on TV. Well, what are you going to do under those circumstances? But this guy did a miraculous job. And afterwards, the United Kingdom nominated him for the Rule of Law Award. And he's another hero. I can't even say his name, because to protect his identity, it's never been made public. But this is the kind of thing that showed me that the Iraqi system was striving to turn the corner and to reestablish the rule of law, that they were good people who were willing to put their lives at risk to do the right thing. And I'll stop it there, but I think when you read the book, what you'll see, one of the things we try to figure out what to subtitle the book, and one of the subtitles we almost used was, "Everything You Think You Know About the Saddam Hussein Trial Is a Little Bit Wrong." Because, in fact, what we learned from the press, what we saw in snippets on television, does not at all tell the real story. Nobody, until now, knows the story I just told you about the Saddam closing argument. You know what the press reported? Saddam was not represented in court on the closing day. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate on this. And I had a similar situation sitting in my office in January of 2005. It wasn't Darth Vader that called me, but it was the Attorney General's office of the UK. So similar, the sense of being somewhat intimidated. I had traveled to Baghdad on a number of times in the previous years as we provided training and setting up training for general judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys on human rights law. This call, though, said, would the International Bar Association be interested in providing training to the judges and the investigative judges and the trial judges for the tribunal? And second, would you consider assisting the tribunal by bringing in a seasoned expert to actually go to Baghdad and to assist on a day-to-day basis? Now, this took me aback a bit because of three reasons, and reasons I had to discuss both with my own mind and also with the management of the IBA. One was the international. We knew that the Iraq Tribunal had the death penalty. The death penalty would be used, and this was a concern. Why? Because most of the international community, not here in the United States, of course, is opposed to the death penalty. The International Bar Association, although it doesn't have a position on it, certainly if I were to ask the 198 members of bar associations who are members of the IBA, they would oppose the death penalty. The European Union opposed the death penalty, and that was sufficient for them not to provide any assistance to the tribunal. The United Nations opposed the death penalty. It was reason enough for the UN not to provide any assistance to this tribunal. So in the end, they were essentially asking, well, whether the IBA would take a counter position and provide the assistance. My position was that should not be the reason why we wouldn't provide assistance to the tribunal. The death penalty, there's not an international prohibition against the death penalty. I may be personally against it, but I didn't think that was reason enough to not engage with the tribunal. The second reason was of the U.S.'s involvement with the tribunal. It is true that this is a domestic, was and is a domestic tribunal. It has Iraqi judges of really the highest quality, Iraqi prosecutors, Iraqi defense attorneys, although the court did permit international defense attorneys to come in. But it was never, in my mind, a domestic court. And the reason is because of the role the United States played. And make no mistake about this, had the United States not played a role in this tribunal, in the sense of the financial support, the support on all aspects of this tribunal, I doubt seriously that the tribunal would have been able to hear its first case, not to mention all the cases that it's heard. The United States was playing a major role with that tribunal, and I was concerned because it was an occupying force whether or not it should play any role with this tribunal. And the third point was, could the tribunal be effective? Could it meet international principles of fairness, international standards of fairness, in this what was a post-conflict environment that was getting a lot worse? So immediately after the fall of Saddam, in my visits to Baghdad, you sensed a degree of hope as to where the country was heading. But it was soon after that that things deteriorated pretty quickly. And that was what the tribunal was dealing with within that environment. So again, whether or not the international community should provide any assistance in that environment, I decided and was able to convince the IBA that we should. Why? because Iraq as a sovereign nation had the responsibility to undertake these trials, to hold individuals accountable. And I thought it was unfair that the international community was essentially saying, well, we really don't have confidence in your ability to do that, so therefore we're not going to provide you any assistance. I thought that was hypocrisy at its height, and I felt that the IBA should proceed with it. And that's what we did. And we started with training programs in London. Michael was part of that training program as well. And in the end, we provided a legal assistant who came down and worked with the judges. And at the same time, we created a back support of 5 international judges who were able to provide assistance to the tribunal when they asked for advice on an issue. For instance, the legality of the court itself, or the issues of command responsibility. We were able to provide, in essence, briefs that went back to the tribunal so they could, in essence, get a sense of what the international community. So now, what do I think in hindsight? I think that's an important issue, and then I'll stop. And I wrote about this several times in about 3 op-eds in the International Herald Tribune during this trial. And I have to say, most of my comments were fairly critical during the trial. Even though we were engaged in supporting it, I felt it was important to speak out. But it was interesting, not for the reasons you might think. And Michael had just, I think, eloquently talked about the challenges that you saw inside the court. And there were many challenges there, and there were many problems, and there were many weaknesses. But I do think, looking back, none of those issues, none of those problems, as chaotic as those issues were, resulted, in my opinion, in an unfair procedure. I thought generally it would meet international standards of fairness, with one exception. And the exception is what causes me to think that in the end, the tribunal will be viewed as having not met international standards of fairness. That had nothing to do with the court. It had nothing to do with the judges, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, nothing. It had everything to do with the Iraqi government. And the interference by the Iraqi government, first in speaking out, in criticizing the court when the government felt the court was not achieving the goals that it should, and then most importantly, actually removing judges from the court for having failed to meet their own perceived standards of what they should or should not be doing. And this occurred during the Dujail trial, and it occurred in the Onfell trial as well. And the sad thing about it is, had the government not done anything in interfering with the court procedures, the results would have been the same. And the international community, I think, would have said these proceedings were fair and they met international standards. But because of their interference, the perception that because of the government interference, these were not independent procedures, I think will stand for a long time. And I think generally history, unfortunately, will judge the trials as having been unfair for that reason alone.
Thank you. Well, let's add a bunch of things, but I know if you want the backstory in terms of the nuances of what happened every day in trial and some of the comings and goings, and if you want to put the political interference in context, I know a great book that helps explain it to you. Michael?
I was just going to say, a lot of other things went wrong during the trial that we all know about. Early on, 2 defense counsel were killed, 1/3 was killed at the end of the trial, and there was the argument, how can you have a fair trial if the defense counsel just keep getting executed and assassinated left
judge
and right,
also.
Right?
Judge killed, some employees killed.
Investigative judge.
Investigative judge, one of my team killed.
There was a problem that the chief judge halfway through the trial resigns. Another judge who was supposed to take over is subject to de-bathification. And then right on the eve of the judgment, they have 5 judges making the final decision, and the newspaper has just broke the story that one of them was replaced for fear that they were against the death penalty. So a lot of that kind of stuff went on. And then you had the boycotts, you had the crazy things that were going on inside the courtroom. It just was probably history's messiest trial. But at the end of the day, I think you're right, Mark, the evidence was so overwhelming. And the one thing they did do a great job of is bringing in the documents, bringing in the witnesses, telling the narrative. And when you read the 298-page opinion, you get a sense that they did prove these incredible events with credible evidence, which is the objective of a war crimes trial. And the sad thing, I think, is that the government played the role of Furman in the O.J. Simpson trial. I mean, I have a hunch that O.J. would have been convicted if not for the fact that the jury believed that Mark Furman wanted to manufacture even more evidence to make sure that there was no chance O.J. would get off, and so he removed the bloody glove from the crime scene and planted it at O.J.'s house. I think that's what the jury ended up concluding, and that's why O.J. gets acquitted. Well, that's what is happening in this case, is that the government, they didn't have to do a thing, as you said. The evidence was overwhelming. It was re ipsa loquitur. You know, the documents with Saddam's own signatures, which were authenticated, spoke for itself, and yet it sounds like they just couldn't help themselves. They just had to interfere, and it was, I think, one of the saddest parts of this.
Yeah,
story.
We didn't even talk about the actual death penalty, the right. actual execution of Saddam Hussein, and if you recall, that being a very chaotic situation, where again you had accusations that the government was interfering simply to accelerate this process of executing Saddam, pushing the appeals court to make a decision within a relatively short period of time. And this all piled on to this perception, and certainly I think, as I said, history will bear this out, that the government was interfering. And even if the government's interference did not have an actual impact or an effect on the trial itself or the result of the trial, the perception is sufficient enough for me to say that the standards were not met.
And Mike, let me add to that perception becomes reality. And that's why the international legal standard about independent, impartial judicial systems is so important. The Iraqis, though, to their great credit, did two things very right in this process. One, the Iraqi legal tradition is not big on full, formal, written legal opinions. And so the statute requires, in accordance with the international practice, a full, developed legal opinion. The Dujail opinion is almost 300 pages long. And I vividly remember before it came out, somebody asked Michael, we actually had a conference, and Michael said, oh, I think they'll produce an opinion about 300 pages long. Well, it's 298 pages in English translated. And people said, ah, proof that the Americans wrote it beforehand and then gave it to them. Well, no. You know, they did do this very well-structured, complex legal opinion. And then, of course, in the Anfal genocide trial, topped themselves, 960-something pages. It's to my knowledge, the longest war crimes opinion in history in terms of the mechanics. So the point being that in spite of all the perceptions from the outside, they did do a very diligent job of going through the records, the evidence, the factual inferences, the defense evidence, the defense arguments, and rebutting them and laying them out on paper for all the world to see. The second point, I think, is in spite of government pressure, and in spite of the one thing the Iraqis really get is the power of the free press. 150 papers in Baghdad. You can find any story you want to find, sometimes scurrious lies, sometimes with a grain of truth, all over the map. Put yourself in Judge Raouf's position. There is government pressure. There is press accounts. There is lots of NGO pressure. There are the murders of defense counsel. Oh, and by the way, the murder of the prosecutor's brother during trial. What do you do in that context? Do you stop trial? Do you take a long 6-month delay? Do you simply throw up your hands in open court and say, well, this was just too ambitious a project? You know, we thought we could do something for the future of Iraq, but we were wrong. In essence, I believe, and this is from conversations with them, they looked at this trial as sort of a branch of the war against terrorism in Iraq. They said, if we succumb to the terrorist manipulation of these murderers, then we let them win. And they didn't want to do that. So in all this vast array of problems, you know, they tried hard to get it right. And where there was government pressure, many times privately, they pushed back on it. And they said, leave us alone. You know, we're doing our job, and that's got no part of it. And this enormous array of other problems that they had to confront. Now, Michael?
I was going to say, and the other problem is that the press had its own story it wanted to tell. And they had access to the defense counsel and to the NGOs, and the court was snake-bitten from the beginning. And the story of the press that was the narrative was this court is part of an extension of the unlawful invasion and it's a disaster. And one of the ways that manifested itself is the story that we all saw about the execution that Mark just mentioned. And I was going to ask Mike if you would tell the other side of that just to show what the press could have showed to get a more holistic view of what went on in those final moments of Saddam's life.
I'll do this in 45 seconds because it's detailed in the chapter, and then we'll take questions from the audience. When the body was turned, when Saddam was flown, you know, the physical custody of Saddam, of course, was a trump for the Americans. We had physical custody. We had total control, the United States, over when and how he was turned over. And so there was this extensive planning process for how the execution would be conducted. There were always rampant rumors, however, across Baghdad that billions of dollars had changed hands to ensure that the dictator wasn't really executed. The Iraqis essentially didn't trust that the Americans wouldn't step in at the last second and retain physical custody or change it. So within minutes of the time he was in Iraqi custody, he was spirited off to a secret location, unbeknownst to the Americans, in a totally unforeseen way, with two court observers and then guards from the Ministry of Justice. The whole colloquy that you saw where Saddam appears on the tape to be this innocent victim, in fact, he started that. Downstairs, there was these taunts and these jibes, a long conversation leading up to that, curses exchanged, lots of heated rhetoric from both sides begun by Saddam. And in fact, as the execution, as we write, the Iraqi people should have had every legitimate expectation that the most important function of their new government would have been done completely appropriately and professionally. The Iraqi government completely mismanaged all that. So on the tape, you hear this cacophony of Arabic voices, and we say, oh, just chaos. In fact, one of those voices is the voice of the Iraqi prosecutor, Munkhathal Faroun, whose picture's in the book, whose brother was murdered during trial. And what he's saying is pleading for dignity and respect and law to be followed, because he knew that those images would color and in some cases tarnish all the work of all the people who had sacrificed and done so much over time. And in fact, that tape itself, 2 minutes and 36 seconds, accomplished all that the defense tried to accomplish through a more than 9-month trial. And more details are in the book. Anyway, questions. We have a few minutes, and we thank you so much, those of you, because we know there's nobody in here that doesn't have a busy schedule, and students who have left books in the library. We appreciate your time, and those of you who have traveled, it means a lot that you're willing to take this chunk of time out of your busy schedules, and so we appreciate that. Any other questions, comments? These are great brains to pick. Yeah?
This is sort of beyond the scope of the book, but I wonder if any of you could comment on the stresses facing Iraqi justice system today in a country which is so divided by sect and tribe in comparison to a relatively not homogeneous but unified American justice system.
Well, you get debates on how unified it is depending on where you go. Good, right?
Iraqi justice system is, first of all, it's different than U.S. justice system. First things, Iraqi judicial system different than Iraqi justice system, because Iraqi judicial council is independent totally from the Minister of Justice, which means Minister of Justice has nothing over the Iraqi judicial council. Judges, prosecutors, and investigators running by the judicial council. Also, to be a judge in Iraq, different than here. You have to graduate from the law school, spend several years working your own work as a legal issues, lawyer, investigator, any, and study again with the judicial institute. This small background. Second thing, Iraqi society is not typical tribal society. Maybe as Mr. Sharf mentioned, you saw the media, and the media has its own agenda. We are in Iraq, yes, part of us is tribal society, but there is many people under the tribe society is educated, modern styles. For that reason, Iraq is not divided by tribal or regions. No. This political agenda, which is, until right now, there is huge debate about the federal process in Iraq. Go with the federal or still like that? How kind of federal we have? You know, which law? Until last 3-4 days, they pass the last law about the election, for the federal election. That means the society itself is not divided by tribal or region or religious or other issues. It's not. But to understand the society, you need a long time to study Iraqi society. Because it is mosaic. It is really different than other societies. Inside Iraq, there is three nationalities. There is three languages. There is many, many customs and traditionals. We have Kurdish language, Arabic language, and Turkoman language. And also there is many minorities, Assyrian, Sabi, and others, you know. Inside the Arab, we have two religions, main religions, Sunni and Shia, Muslim and non-Muslim. Muslim divided in difference, Sunni and Shia, non-Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Sabi, and others. In Turkoman, they divided. Some, their backgrounds came from Turkey, some came from the Turkmenistan. In Kurdish region, it's called Kurdistan, there is two languages inside, you know. It's very unique society, very, very unique. And we try to put all the society together, and the legal system, we have one legal system from 1921, until now, except the last, I think 17 years, there is Kurdistan legal system, but also it's part of the Iraqi legal system. Right now, we are running as a federal system, one system. There is no divide till this minute, except the Kurdistan. And also Kurdistan took most of their laws from the central governments. There is maybe very, very simple exceptions here. Yeah.
All right, we have time for maybe two or three. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Could you comment a little bit on John Burns' article in the New York Times last Thursday that basically made the case or argued that the interference of the Iraqi government was more extensive than was reported? And I mean, Burns uses the term railroaded, so that would say.
Number one, look at page 187, since I know you've bought a copy of the book, Tom. Page 187. And we all have talked about this, and I think each of us will have a brief comment on this. The main person quoted is Bill Wiley, the Canadian defense lawyer. And part of it is perspective, right? Bill is what I've termed an outside insider. Right, he's representing the defense counsel. So, in fact, everything he's reporting is second and third and fourth hand brought to him specifically by people who have an agenda. Now, there's no doubt whatsoever that there was very strong feelings by the Iraqi government about a number of issues during the trial, and that, in fact, the huge perception of illegitimate interference is there across the board. I will tell you, and this is attorney-client privilege, so I can't give a lot of the details, that was felt by the court and also resisted by the court in a lot of ways. So in fact, what Bill is reporting is true. I mean, a judge did change. But we have no idea, if any, the effect on trial, the effect on deliberations, you know, the message that was sent, and the real at bottom line, the human rights standard is that the death penalty, capital punishment, can only be inflicted in the context of a fully independent, fully impartial panel exercising its own independent judgment. Now, the question at the end of the day is, did that happen or not? And I think the right answer is, it doesn't look like it might have happened in some ways, but we really don't know.
Yeah, I would say, whatever the effect was on the trials in reality, it doesn't matter. Because there's no standard, and I speak international from an international legal perspective, there's no international legal principle that would permit a government to come in essence, over a period of a trial and a half, because the Anfield trial was the second one, to essentially pressure out four judges. The game is over with, in my mind. You just cannot reach that, and it is frustrating that's what has happened. And I suspect this is just what Burns is talking about. I think we'll see more of this coming up, because we knew it was happening during the trial, but we're finding even deeper concerns.
Although, let me add just as one thought, and then Michael, I know, has opinions on this. When you talk to the Iraqis, and you say to the president of the court, you say, look, you're the president of the court. It is your job, where there is government pressure, to push back and to resist that. They understand that. They get that. And he will tell you, I am doing that. And you say, well, all right, let's go down the examples. And within the court, and you can argue that it's rationalizations, it's simply the only way of surviving and thriving in that charged political atmosphere. But in fact, on legal grounds, they will tell you, well, here's the process, here's what happened with this judge under these circumstances, and they will justify it. So there's never been, in my conversations with them, oh yeah, we just did what the politicians wanted us to do. That's just not the way they would articulate it. Michael?
Let me add this. There was concern from the very beginning that there would be external pressure, and so there were sort of mechanisms built in to withstand that. One of the mechanisms is, unlike a U.S. bench trial that has one judge, or an international criminal tribunal trial, like the Yugoslavia tribunal or Rwanda tribunal, that have three judges, they decided to have five judges to make the trial court decision, and seven judges to make the appeals court decision, so that there would be a limited opportunity for any one judge to make a huge difference. Now, in this case, the government did replace one of the five judges during the proceedings, but there were still four other judges. And I think, reading the judgment, that the evidence was so overwhelming that it, with respect to Saddam Hussein, had no effect at all. And also, if you want to see a counter argument for whether this had any effect at all on the judgment, the trial chamber gave the life sentence to Vice President Ramadan. And that was notwithstanding the insertion of this judge, whose job, I suppose, the public thinks, was to ensure the death penalty. And it wasn't until the appeals chamber reversed that decision and upped the sentence to death for Judge Ramadan that he got that sentence. But if in fact Burns is right, if in fact this one action did influence it, then why didn't they get the death penalty for Ramadan at the trial level? I think it indicates that the four other judges were still acting independently of the government, whatever that one fifth additional judge's position ended up being in the deliberations.
Also, I want to add one piece is here. The verdict is made by majority, which means if we have three judges, it's more than enough. Three against two, that's it. No. But the verdicts came with all the five, which means if they just replace one, it's not.
And one more small technical thing, not that I'm trying to sell books, but I'd like to sell books. we are very objective throughout the book, very fair about assessing both the facts and the story, but in fact, at the end of the day, there's a lot of criticisms in the book, and I think one of the very legitimate criticisms which we make is that if you're going to increase the sentence, and one of the great defects of the appeals judgment, and in fact the Taha second appeal, is if you're going to aggregate a sentence, in this case, refer a case which is perfectly lawful back to the trial chamber for reassessment of sentence. In that case, he'd been given life imprisonment. They said, send it back for a more severe sentence. Well, what does that mean? It means death. But in the opinion, there is no articulation of the detailed, precise grounds of extenuation and mitigation, all the law warranting that sort of really kind of radical opinion. Well, this is still a work in progress. And so, we've made that comment publicly that they have to go back and justify that. It's not enough just to say it, which they can do under domestic law, but under international standards, they've got to go back and justify it. All right, last comment,
last
observation.
Can I say one thing? I know there's a question, but I didn't want it to pass here, because the book also, and I really encourage you to get a copy of this, because it's a phenomenal read and a very insightful read. And one of the things that Michael has alluded to, but I think it's so important, and it comes out of this book, is really the failure, and I say this for a lot of the young students here who may go into the defense side of law, the failure of the defense, and particularly those attorneys who were selected by Saddam Hussein and his colleagues, was absolutely overwhelming. It was one of the poorest, one of the poorest defense that I've ever witnessed and watched. And it goes to the what happens later in other trials, domestic trials. How do you ensure that defendants have competent defense counsel who are also not going to use this as a platform for their own political cause? Because that was a huge weakness, I thought, in these trials. And even Ramsey Clark, for older people in the audience, you'll know who he is. But the fact that he was an outside defense counsel that came in and he did what he did. He obstructed the proceedings. He should be disbarred here in the United States. I doubt he is, but he should be, because that was reprehensible.
Mark, you said you saw one more question or observation.
I thought it was up. Yeah.
Yes.
I just wanted to say thank you to all of you. Not necessarily, I was hoping to just hear some of the stories. I know the book or just the inspirational stories, and so I guess I wanted to ask all of you sort of what sustained you and what helped you sort of work through some of the issues that maybe came up, and sort of from a personal standpoint. How do you feel about being part of such an important and significant moment in history?
Michael? I recently had the opportunity to go to the Cambodia Tribunal, where they are facing challenges equal to the Iraqi High Tribunal. And the Cambodian judges were very interested in knowing what the lessons were of the Iraqi High Tribunal so that they could do things better. And I think that the Iraqi High Tribunal and the Saddam Hussein trial will earn its place in history. It already has, both for its successes, which may be minor, maybe it's a little bit like saying to Mrs. Lincoln, other than that, how did you enjoy the show? But on the other hand, the lessons from this are going to be very instructive and important. And already the Cambodia Tribunal, and the next big case is the Karadzic case, and they're focusing very much on how do we avoid allowing Karadzic to do to us what Saddam and his lawyers were able to do in Baghdad.
I was inspired when I first met Judge Rod and his colleagues at the first training in London. These 20-odd judges, investigative judges, trial judges came in. They represented, they were Shia, Sunni, Kurds, but they were all there for the purpose of upholding justice in this nascent country of theirs, this new democratic system. And the first night we were there was when news came that the first investigative judge who was not with us, had stayed in Baghdad, had been killed. And all of these judges were just in tears. Sharing the loss and recognizing the challenges that they would face over the next 2 years. And that was inspirational, and that's what drove me to continue to provide whatever assistance I could. Quite amazing people that we met with.
I can't talk about myself, but I talk about my colleagues there. They are really, really heroes facing all the problems, all the security issues to help their country, to help our country to rebuild it again. And I all the time said, you have to build your home because your neighbor will help you, but it's your honor and your duty to help to build your home. Yes, this our responsibilities is there, and as my colleagues still working there. Maybe I'm here now, but I'm in touch with them daily, frankly. And history will give them the fair and the right issues next time. And our generation, next generation in Iraq, will understand what the Iraqi High Tribunal means in Iraqi justice. And also, I'm sure the American history will mention the High Tribunal with honor proud. That's part of the justice in the Middle East established the first time to prosecute the president and his assistant and the prime ministers and everybody is there when they try to torture or kill their societies without any reasons. Yeah, that's our responsibility and we're proud to do that.
Judge Rod won't talk about himself, but I will. You see the soul of a people, the soul of a judiciary that understands that it represents much broader principles than just, there's a quote in the book. A reporter asked Judge Rod one day, why do you keep doing this, in this chaos, in this sense of senselessness, in this, at that time anyway, when the question was asked, grievous ethnic violence on one on the other. And he says, and this is a paraphrase, the quote's in the book, he looks at the reporter, Judge Rod, and he says, this is a battle, mister. If I stay home, and you stay home, and the next guy stays home, there can be no victory. He said, this is a battle. There's only two choices. We will either win or we will lose. And I choose to engage on the side of good. That's my paraphrase. We put the quote in the book from Teddy Roosevelt, famous speech called the Man in the Arena speech. The gist of it is that the credit belongs to the man who's in the ring, whose face is marred by sweat and he's dirty. The credit doesn't belong to the people that stand on the sidelines. And when people like this, not just in Iraq, but in Cambodia, in Uganda, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Sierra Leone, in, dare I say, Alabama, that are standing up on the side of truth and justice and freedom. As lawyers, I think you have a professional obligation to reach out and help them. And that's what inspires me, is the fact that you'll find those people, if you listen and you look through the cultural lens to gauge them in their own societal context, you will find that sense of legal professionalism all around the world. So to my students, I would say, look for that. And never let them feel like they're alone, that you're always at their side. And that, in fact, I think is the highest calling of professional lawyers. Thank you so much for your time and attention. The reception food is getting cold upstairs. Please join us.